Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming along tonight. It's very good of you to give up your evening on such a beautiful evening. Welcome to the Institute of Actuaries, especially if you're a non-actuary. It's particularly good to have visitors with us. And also welcome to the Risk Management Special Interest Group. I think it's fair to say that the role of the actuary has changed an awful lot in recent times. And surely that process is going to continue. And I think risk management is potentially going to be the biggest driver of change for our profession in the next few years. So what we want to do tonight is to explore what it is that we as actuaries can offer in the area of risk management. What are the skills that we have that are special? And we also want to identify some of the actions that the Institute should be taking in order to ensure that we take the opportunities before us as a profession. And there are some fantastic opportunities ahead of us. I think if we get it right, we can all enjoy, hopefully, more interesting work as individuals, greater career choice potentially as new horizons open up. But we also have the opportunity to have a greater influence on the decision-making of our clients and our employers. And it's really in response to those opportunities that the Institute has set up this special interest group. That has generated quite a big response from the membership. We've got about 500 people who've signed up to be members of this group in over 20 countries, so we're delighted by that. We're very much at the start of a journey in terms of what we want to do. So we've asked the membership for their views of what we should do as a group. And tonight we're going to feed back a little about what the members have said. And then we're going to try and talk about what we actually do about those views and how we move forward. So the key tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is for you to tell us what you think. We're not a working group. This is a special interest group. It's all of us working together. So we aren't going to tell you the answers. We need you to tell us what you want us to do. So the key word tonight is to participate. We need you to speak up, especially some of the younger folk. Do talk to us tonight. So to give some context to the evening, James Orr is going to present a little bit about what was said in response to the survey to bring out some of the ideas that have already been expressed so that we can build on those tonight. And then Peter Vipon to my left, Peter is going to talk a little bit about some of the things that he's seeing. Peter's very well positioned. He's the Director of Financial Regulation and Taxation at the ABI, so he sees across the whole of the industry. He's also going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Solvency II, which is surely going to be a big driver for us as a profession in the next few years. So my thanks to James and to Peter for sharing their opinions. We're going to finish at 7:30 prompt. That is my main job, to make sure that happens. We've got some refreshments laid on afterwards. The time will absolutely fly by if you all participate. As well as speaking tonight, we also need some volunteers going forward to get stuck into all the exciting things that are going to come up tonight. So if you'd like to volunteer, there are two ways to do that. The first is to see James or myself or Paul Stanworth, who's in charge of the whole group. See us afterwards and come and say what you'd like to do. The second way to volunteer is to give me the secret signal. The secret signal tonight will be a few beeps from your mobile phone. So you have been warned. James is going to take the floor and tell us a little bit about the response to the survey. James.
Thank you very much, Steve. Well, first, the obvious thing to say is, David said, thank you very much all for coming. We had a bit of a discussion last week, David and myself, because Tilly asked, who my employer, decided to run a Solvency II workshop tonight. So I'm assuming that we've got mostly consultants here this evening, but also the people who didn't accept the Tilly asked cover. So we're going for world domination this evening. So as David was saying, we've done the introductions. The overview I'm going to provide you with is just to talk you through what we're going to achieve or hope to achieve this evening. I'm first going to just emphasise or try and focus in on what the purpose of this evening is. We've tried to kind of express that in a kind of simple kind of question. Then we're going to be handing over to our guest speaker, who's Peter Vipon from the ABI. and we're not doing too bad on the kind of time frame at the moment. We told Peter to spend 7.5 minutes talking to you, so we've kept us rolling. Actually, that's 15 minutes scheduled, so that should be giving him plenty of time to go through his kind of important comments. And then I'm going to drone on the risk management special interest group questionnaire, unless you guys actually contribute, in which case there'll be a much more interesting evening, as David was saying. So what I'm going to go through is just the kind of main areas within the questionnaire under a few kind of top headings, and then some of the key points and quotes. There's some very good quotes, actually. I think we'd say that the quality of the questionnaire responses was excellent, really. We've got some really kind of thoughtful contributions, and that's why we want to make the best of this evening in terms of identifying, you know, what do we do next? The way we're thinking about it is we've got 500 people who've said, yeah, we're interested, we think this is important, we'd be willing to contribute to that. Now we're going to try and decide, okay, well, where are we going to stick the kind of the stick in the sand, and we're going to kind of all head in that direction. Where is that direction going to be? What are we going to do that's actually going to help to realise this kind of risk management vision once we've got a clear idea as to what that is for the actuarial profession? So what we're going to look at is the kind of big question. We'll come to that in a minute, and hopefully in the last kind of minute or so, the big idea will emerge. I mean, those of you who have read kind of Chegger's Guide to the Galaxy will remember at the end of the kind of big experiment, which was the creation of the Earth, somebody actually came up with a solution just as the Earth was destroyed. So hopefully that won't be the case for us this evening. But I'll make a few kind of popular cultural references as we go through. And those of you who know me will know that. Anybody recognise what's on the top right-hand corner there?
The Incredibles. The story of the Incredibles. The story of the Incredibles is about a superhero. Superhero you've not seen before. There's someone who lived in a simpler world of good and bad. And then suddenly the world changed because of litigation. And suddenly the superhero who was saving people falling from tall buildings was being sued by people who fall from tall buildings because they were trying to kill themselves. And they had spoiled their death as the court was giving them. So this is about change and people who've got exceptional kind of powers or exceptional responsibilities. One could argue that was the actuary of the past. The world has changed for them. There are lots of people now who've got techniques and specialisms which could claim to say, yes, we can solve these financial risk management problems. You don't need an actuary for that. And I think, you know, the world has changed for actuaries. So the purpose of this evening is, against the background of a changing environment for actuaries, is to explore the role that risk management might play in our future, and also to identify what the profession should do to make this happen. And you'll see here that I'm going to refer to risk management by RM for short. It's always good to have a little acronym. And also we're saying that, you know, we've got a role to play within risk management as well. Is risk management going in a direction that is, you know, is correct, that is informed, that is sound, that is rigorous, or should actuaries be contributing to that as well? And also we've decided that, you know, in the context of what the profession is going to do with regard to risk management, that's going to be through the risk management special interest group. So there you go. That's the purpose of this evening. I want to now hand over to Peter. Hopefully.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I've got 10 minutes or so just to really go through one main thing, which is the convergence of regulation and risk management, because it seems to me that changes quite profoundly the way financial institutions work, and therefore the way in which actuaries could potentially work within them. There's not always been the case that the regulatory returns, the regulatory environment and risk management were that closely connected. Indeed, one could be forgiven in the not-too-distant past of thinking of them as being somewhat divergent. Those of you familiar with the banking side of things will know that for a long time, the Basel Accord has struggled to get up to date with the actual risks that banks handle. And even the new Basel II work, which is supposed to be relatively sophisticated, from the perspective of an actuary, is dull and old-fashioned at inception and really doesn't offer very much in the way of sophisticated management. Some sophisticated arbitrage opportunities for investment banks, but actually for sophisticated risk management, I think it's quite weak. Indeed, in the 1990s, when the Capital Adequacy Directive, which was not primarily an insurance directive, I'm going to talk about insurance briefly now, was introduced, I was very struck, working in the banking industry at the time, just how isolated the young risk managers dealing with CAD were from the mainstream of their management in most institutions, with a few honourable exceptions. How it was often the case they had a room on a different floor and they were asked to do these calculations and produce them to keep the FSA or Bank of England, as it then was, off the back of senior management. But they weren't in any way integrated into the risk process and into the senior management activities of the firm. And I think both for banking and insurance, that's changed. And it's changed because of some of the serious market issues we've had in the early part of this century that have brought about fundamental changes bit by bit in the UK and potentially now on the continent. So the thesis, if you like, putting it another way, is that financial regulation is becoming more risk-based. Basel II, Solvency II, unlike Solvency I, is going to be a risk-based approach. It's actually going to be very radical, much more radical than anything the banks have got, because it will allow an insurance group to internally model all their main categories of risks. And that's something that's a real move forward, as you will know, from Solvency I, and indeed from the current FSA rules. But let's not knock the FSA too much. The ICAS system, which the FSA have introduced, has been a remarkable move forward for this industry and has been a real sea change in requiring insurers under a Pillar 2 model as opposed to a Pillar 1 calculation to assess what the real risks are, quantitative, in some cases not quantitative, and put them into a package and get their senior people to defend that to the regulator. Now, some of that has been a painful process. It's been an expensive process. In some companies, they've ducked it and got one of these dreaded consultants in to do it for them, which isn't what they're supposed to do. But in general, it's been a liberating process, and it has brought about a sea change in the way firms react or relate to the FSA in the way in which they think about risks internally. Remember, though, ICAS is in very much a Pillar 2 development in UK terms. Solvency II, I'm sure many of you are reading up on that and watching what's going on there. Solvency II will extend this in some ways to all of the European insurance industry. Great opportunity, by the by, for European insurance, European actuaries, to get a degree of world leadership, if that's what you wanted. I think we were talking about hegemony before. If you were looking for aspirations, that's a great opportunity, not least because of the sad and sorry state of financial services regulation in the US, particularly in insurance in comparison. But there is a mistake that the Brits usually make, which is that basically the UK regime will be written down and all these Europeans will adopt it. And it's not going to be quite like that. The UK is widely regarded by the continental regulators, but not that heavily or not that widely regarded. And there will be some real changes, it seems to me. What I think will happen, what has happened to some degree in the UK anyway, is ICAS will become a much more formalised regime. That is to say, there will be less discretion, less discretionary judgments by the regulator. So you'll have to go up and get firmer, tighter numbers from the outset. I don't think ICAS is equivalent to the kind of modelling that Solvency II will require, for example. I think that's another stage forward, something which, frankly, an insurance company, actuaries, whether they call themselves risk managers or not, will have to be at the heart of, because there's no other function, no accounting function, no general finance function that could carry the degree of sophistication of that modelling. But a lot of the current ICAS numbers will move into Pillar 1, out of Pillar 2 in Solvency 2. It will become part of that initial capital calculation. And I think that does pose real challenges for the actuarial profession in meeting the requirements of that in Pillar 1. And it does mean that Pillar 2, I think, will be more generic. It'll be more about risk governance in the firm. It'll be more about risk appetite. And I think it's perfectly possible that actuaries will have a key role to play in Pillar 2, but only with a wider view of risk management. So risk managers in Pillar 1, in many ways, it seems to me, I hope you stand up to that challenge, because there's nobody else who's really going to be able to do it for the most part. Pillar 2, I think, is a more open question. Just want to go back to ICAS a bit for this slide, and to be brief about it, because it seems to me that there were a number of things behind ICAS. There were a number of things behind the changes to insurance regulation that we've seen in this country in this century. The early stuff, around 2003, after the FSA had announced they were going to fundamentally rethink insurance regulation, and frankly going to rethink it off a base that was grossly inadequate and flawed. there's no point in ducking it. It was in a pretty poor state by the end of the last century relative to the kind of products that were being sold, the kind of market risks that were out there. And of course, 2002, 2003, London Stock Exchange down at 3.3, it exposed the fundamental lack of quality of pricing of risk that a lot of companies were doing, and the fact that they did not have the capital to maintain a robust position in the event of the severe market risk shocks that they then suffered. And many people in this room perhaps were involved, I know some on the panel were, in the debate about stochastic modelling for with-profits, a very technical debate that produced essentially a strong, robust analytical methodology, an actuarially driven methodology for that, extended out to asset shares and those products, and then taken on further to some on in terms of board responsibility we'll come back to. But the FSA from the outset, I think in part building on what they did with the banks, those of you who know your trigger and target ratios from the banking industry, it's the same sort of game to a degree, but recognize the need to have a more comprehensive risk assessment process. And for me, that's the issue of what the future for actuaries is in risk management, is around that. The pillar one stuff, you're there whether you like it or not. But this sort of ICAS pillar two work, I think, is it's not so obvious, but it's by no means the case that actuaries don't have a role there. So they were looking to improve risk management, and they were looking as part of that, going back to a comment I made a little while ago, a slightly flip comment, to get senior management back in the driving seat and to manage both its capital and capital against its risks. And I think that's something the FSA and other regulators have struggled to do, to get the buy-in and the engagement of senior management with the risk process. In some institutions, maybe some represented in this room, it's been achieved and there's a clear understanding of what that means. But in many others, I think it's still the case that the board struggles to find and the executive directors struggle to find a way of having a risk analysis presented to them other than in the annual forms, or whatever they are, in a way that allows them to make decisions and to monitor things. So the FSA were very keen to try and do that, and they've always wanted, they've struggled and it hasn't always worked, but they've always wanted to use that information, the management information, as the basis of the way they supervise the firm. And hence the theme, if you like, of these few remarks about convergence. And in doing it, I think they wanted to get to this complete and coherent view of the capital adequacy of a firm. Does the firm have the right amount of capital? Can it raise additional capital for the number and the diversity of the risks that it runs? That has been and continues to be a big issue. As those of you who are currently doing your ICAS will know, even around things today, around things like operational risk, how do you grasp that? How do you model that? What kind of diversification can you have on that? But that's the goal, and it's certainly something which we haven't got to yet, but Solvency II will take it in a somewhat different direction. What will Solvency II do? Well, I was told I only had 7 minutes, so you can be glad you haven't got 20 slides and the pillar one, pillar two, pillar three, and all the kind of stuff that you could have, and if you ever invite me back again, then I'll do it for you if you really want. But it's an exciting period. It really is a quite fabulously exciting period for insurance on the continent and in the UK, because we are having a network that is started with Basel, but from an actuarial perspective, from a risk perspective, is so much more sophisticated. It really will require the firms to model and measure their risk as never before, and firms will be required to put that appropriate risk management systems in place in Pillar 2, and the bit that everyone forgets, the Pillar 3, they will have to disclose much more of that to the market than they ever thought they'd ever be asked to do. I mean, there are debates at the moment about obliging firms to disclose, for example, their capital guidance number, not just their ICA number, but the actual capital guidance, and there's certainly a very active debate that when firms drop below their SCR and Solvency II, they will, even if they're not quoted stock market firms, be obliged to make a formal announcement of that and disclose it. So you'll be in a much more transparent environment, a much more open environment, and that's an area where the quality of skills that good actuaries can bring in terms of the getting the numbers right. It's never just the numbers, getting the sophistication of numbers right, but making those numbers work for management will be so much more important than it is even now. And they will have to do this in Solvency II language. We talk about own risk solvency capital assessment. They will have to do that as part of the way they run their businesses. So there's a real challenge, it seems to me, in Solvency II to rise to that. There's tremendous career opportunities, I think we were talking about before. Frankly, on the continent, there just aren't the number and the quality of persons to do this. There's a real issue about whether the supervisory community will have the number of people to assess this. In all these areas, actuaries will either be playing a role themselves in their own right, or I believe, much more importantly, will be generating the kind of analysis, not just the numbers, though they're always important, the kind of analysis to allow regulators, to allow investors, to allow markets, to allow a whole range of other key stakeholders to be able to assess the performance of insurance companies. And that's certainly coming down the line in Solvency II, and 2010 looks to be the deadline by which we will have it. So where will the actuary fit into this? Certainly assessment of risk appetite will be key. Actuaries will be relied upon, I think, not just to assess the risk, but to help work with the capital raising groups to work out what it is that a firm has wanted to do. So far, and I think this has been rather disappointing, firms have tended to become much less creative or adventurous in their risk appetite. One of the things we've seen, and I think it's the downside of a lot of the regulatory change we've had so far, is that firms have always coming to us and talking about wanting capital-light products. The insurance companies don't want the risk. And bloody hell, if anyone should be taking the risk, it's the insurance companies. And what's happened to the regulatory changes are forcing them away from that, forcing them, because of the pressures of the market, to all the time wanting to become... If I was being snooty, I would say glorified unit trust managers. And that really has got to be challenged by actuaries to find ways in which we can go back to the much more structured products that are risky, but which actuarial methodologies can manage in a modern environment, so that insurance companies can get back to that critical role, which I think they're shying away from, of tackling some of those really big risks that they are at the moment, it seems to me, and if you look at the way that some of them are pulling out of annuities, if you look at the way they're not looking at those variable annuities very much, with some honourable exceptions, if you're looking at the way in which the GI side, a lot of the single risks, the complex risks going to London market and the mainstream firms are ducking it. So risk appetite, key, reinventing the insurance industry is not too strong a way of putting it. Controlling that as part of a risk process, not a static return. Continuing battle we have with our continental friends, particularly from places like Germany, is that all too often they see the risk process as an almost annual filling in of the form. And as long as you've done it, and you've done it legally correctly, and you've used the right definitions, then hopefully the regulator will go away and leave you alone for a year, and then you can do the form again. A bit like it was here, I think, in the past. We've got to try and get a more dynamic approach to risk. Risk management, not a kind of one-off or a series of simply one-off decisions about that. And that, I think, will be a big challenge for the European industry. We've got to find a way in which actuaries, either on the board or feeding to it, can pick up on this board ownership issue. And most importantly, I think, the actuaries have got this key role in taking the ICA now, or the ORSA as it will be, into the firm. So that the way in which all I've talked about on transparency means that actuaries, either themselves or in support of colleagues, are enabling insurers to communicate to the market the kind of risks they're taking and the measurement of those risks in a way which, frankly, at the moment, they're not succeeding in doing, and which is leading to them to duck some of the risks that they alone, it seems to me, are well positioned to take. So, a call to arms, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone from the floor have any immediate comments on Peter's remarks? Please.
I'm Kieran Barnes, I'm from the FSA, and I was heavily involved in rolling out the ICAS regime for life insurers. I think we made a lot of progress over the last two or three years, in particular getting the technical grounding of the ICAS models in place. The one area where I think that the FSA haven't focused too much on, and we are looking for the industry to actually progress more, is in embedding the models and in using the models. We're not, under the ICAS regime, trying to get mathematical perfection in what we're doing. What we do want to see is have a risk system which is embedded within the business. Now, we're well used to having embedded risk systems when we talk to banks or when we talk to investment managers, because they have something which they monitor on a day-to-day basis. That's their industry. That's the way they do it. I think I'd like to do is ask if the special interest group, is that part of actually what you're trying to do, is to actually get this embeddedness, to get the communication of what risks you're taking, as well as actually trying to find some of the solutions to mitigating these risks.
Profession to develop rounded professionals who can, as I said to Peter upstairs, not just do the numbers, and he pointed out that just doing the numbers is actually very, very important and very difficult task. So there's a big thing that we have to do there to get the numbers right. But we want to equip actuaries who can, so that we can do more than just that, that we can add the analysis, that we can do the things that you've just talked about communicating to management, but also communicating to the market. Peter's talked about the increased transparency that's going to be coming along. Maybe there's a piece of the space that we need to be grabbing for ourselves to help people communicate to the market the complexity of what insurance is and the sort of risks that we take. So I think the special interest group has a role to play in developing the capability of the profession so that the people who are coming through passing their exams are equipped to do just that. And we are going to talk during the rest of the meeting about some of the education aspects of that. Maybe we need to be changing the way that we educate our students so that they can grasp hold of that nettle.
Hi, Steve Nuttall. I'd just like to pick up on I think the points have been made by all three speakers. If this is not about more than just the numbers, then we'll be failed straight away. The numbers are clearly important, but I think we have a fantastic opportunity to really lead across the industry in developing and embedding risk cultures. Not an easy thing to do. And having seen how the vast majority of actuaries seem to manage risk in their own areas, they're not always a good example. But I think we've got to change that for start and actually get actuaries leading by example. So communication and actually getting out of the business is crucial. I was really interested in the point that Peter made about the industry moving towards capital-like products. I do think this is a great failing of the industry. And to some extent, I mean, I think ICAS has actually been a great success in many ways in getting boards thinking much more about risk and capital than they've done before. But unfortunately, I think it's had this tendency still to reinforce the how little capital can we get away with, rather than a sensible debate about how we can actually allocate the appropriate amount of capital to support the strategies in our business. So a major area for the actuarial profession for me is educating boards on this link between strategy, capital and risk. And actually, strategy is about options, about how you can deploy resources, capital in various ways to achieve different outcomes. And it's kind of like expenses. Yes, you can go for a very low-cost strategy, but there are other strategies as well. And I think we could certainly be leading the way in helping boards understand the impact of different strategies, different capital management policies, and different outcomes, and leading on to the sharing of risk and better products for people out there who really don't want to take the risk.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'll go through now the feedback we got from the risk management questionnaire. Thanks to David and his colleagues for summarising that for us. That's nearly done. Right. The profile of respondents. Our special interest group comprises getting on for 500 people who have said, yes, we are interested in risk management, we want to be part of this debate, this discussion, the development as to where we should take the actuarial profession. More than half of those numbers actually responded, which is pretty exceptional, really. And I chair the actuarial profession's research steering committee, so I'm always interested in what people think about research. A little bit disappointed with the findings of the questionnaire in that regard, and then on to education as well. So, as regards our kind of participation profile, coming back to Mr. Incredible, after he was found to be too expensive an asset for the country to have righting wrongs and capturing the baddies and things, they put him into retirement. They actually had a programme where they put them into hidden environments. And he became an insurance specialist working for InsureCare. And his job was as a kind of claims assessor. But of course, even then, he was trying to defend right against wrong, and he was trying to help people actually get their insurance claims paid, which didn't make him very popular with his little boss. I'll show you his little boss now in a few more slides. Anyway, coming back to the participation, I'm just putting these in here to keep you awake, by the way. But practice area, the majority were life actuaries. Now, I think this has been quite interesting. We had a debate, I think it was last year, where we had a life pensions and... was it a life of pensions and a general insurance actuary? I think we had giving talks on risk management. And there was a show of hands as to, okay, which of these three characters is the most sophisticated from a risk management perspective. And it was surprising how well general insurance did, but life insurance was regarded as being the most sophisticated, the most advanced in terms of risk management. I think it's probably a function of both experience and circumstances, the kind of extent to which pensions actuaries actually have control and are being pushed by regulation kind of in this direction, and also what kind of things have perhaps gone wrong within life and general insurance sectors as well. So we saw quite a healthy response from the three main areas. Then we've got investment banking and then a kind of large group who are under other. And certainly I saw a paper under the International Actuarial Association looking at actuaries in banking, and they did a survey of how many actuaries involve in banking these days, and it is a surprisingly large amount. I mean, even within the UK, you're looking at four figures, including investment banking, investment kind of management within that. It's a very large quantity of actuaries who are involved in what we'd regard as kind of banking areas. The majority were looking to apply their knowledge within existing areas. They didn't see risk management as a kind of passport out of being a general insurance actuary or a life actuary. They were looking at what risk management could do for them in their own role. And also, as regards kind of risk management affiliations, some of the usual suspects came up there: Premier, GARP, Firm, CFA, the Society of Actuary Risk Management Sector has been mentioned previously. It's been going for quite a few years now and has enjoyed a great deal of success, and a lot has been achieved under that. So into the actual kind of responses we got back. Most of you are interested in attending risk management events in 2007, so here we are. And looking at average participations, we're looking at kind of three networking evenings, one half-day seminar, one full-day seminar, but you balked at us going the whole hog and having a big conference, and that's probably a reflection of just how far this discussion has got. We really are very much in kind of exploratory kind of phase of things at the moment. And people were interested in generic risk management events. You'd come to something like this. You wouldn't necessarily come as a pensions actuary to a life event or a kind of life actuary to a GI event looking at a risk management issue. And also we did have quite a lot of overseas participants. We mentioned before there were some 20 countries who are represented within the risk management special interest group. One participant commented that half-day seminars would require a whole day, including travel. So we'll take account of that if we're looking at beyond kind of evening events. So then actually looking at the topics that people want to cover, I've got some specific quotes here. People are interested in the risks arising from low frequency but extremely high impact events. And I tend to assume that relates mainly to general insurance actuaries in context of fixed targets and the like. Certainly speaking to some life actuaries, I think the view is that you sometimes struggle to find just how extreme the circumstances need to be in order to test this very kind of challenging assessment of capital requirements in a life context. Be interested in, I mean, David, you had some views on that.
Yeah, I think part of the ICAST regime life actually generally got to grips with market risk. Generally, we could still probably do it better, but generally we have. But I don't think we've got a very good understanding of some of the other how extreme scenarios could operate. So what's an extreme mortality event? It's hard for us to judge. We struggle even to know what a standard level of mortality improvement is, let alone a near worst case is. So I think we have got a lot to learn on the sort of amount of variation that we can see in our businesses.
Anybody else got a kind of comment on that regarding extremes, looking at extremes? Please.
I'm
running mic, we'll catch up with you.
Thank you. I think one of the obvious extreme mortality events would be a bird flu pandemic or something like that. I mean, the Bank of England and the FSA have run sort of operational risk type scenarios in the banking environment, but I don't think anybody's thought about it from a life insurance perspective. So, I mean, it's topical at least.
Yes. Yeah. Please,
Louise. Not sort of sector specific, but obviously some operational risks would fall into that category too.
And that would be for an individual company or more widely? Both, yeah. So kind of the new Microsoft software doesn't work. People can't get the PowerPoint slides to work. Okay. The next thing that came up was best practice risk management frameworks, organisational committee structures. And this kind of highlights perhaps the problem with risk management. It's too broad. You know, is it about, you know, just answering a specific kind of extreme risk question, or is it about how you actually organise a company? And I think I certainly personally struggle with how do you, in the same breath, talk about something which seems quite kind of qualitative in many ways, kind of organisational structures, governance issues, and at the same time talk about some kind of hedging solution. And I do have trouble kind of squaring that, and I wonder if perhaps we'd have an issue of mission stretch coming back to this. You know, it's an exciting time for actions. You know, should we stay in the kind of in the numerical kind of cupboard and just work on the numbers? And can we actually function, you know, with credibility and effectiveness and get our voice heard if we moved into this kind of broader kind of risk governance environment? This was a suggestion, please. Maybe we should have the...
I couldn't really agree with you on that one in the sense of if actuaries get involved in risk management, whatever it is, then surely there's a need to be able to define how to do it well. And so, in effect, a framework is there to describe how to do it well. Organisation committee structures are basically how to do that well in large organisations. So you can disagree what risk covers, you can disagree what risk management means, but if actuaries are to be involved in it, then this is a key part of it.
And not to
kind of
enable the quantitative
into the decision making. Risk management, in my view, the quantitative bits are a subset of risk management.
Yes, I agree with that. Please.
Sorry, just on that point. Surely the very first thing about risk management is risk isn't something in a box over there that actuaries or clever mathematical people can play with while the business gets on with something over here. It's actually something that pervades the entire business, and anybody who purports to be a risk manager has got to be able to work across the entire business in that way as well. So the answer to that question must be unequivocally, yes, let's use our financial skills, but it has to be taken out across the business because that's where the risk is.
And do you think historically perhaps some of the things that have gone wrong are because of that connection between the quantification and the decision making?
Partly, yes. I mean, certainly historically there hasn't been some very bright mismanagement, but where there has been, it's been kind of kept in a silo over there without relation, you know, sort of a understanding how what's happening in the business will actually impact it.
Thank you. This is an interesting comment, getting down to specific techniques in relation to hedging.
I just wanted to make one more comment about risk management decision making. Coming back from what Peter's saying, even in the environment where Pillar 2, Peter was talking about Pillar 2 becoming more about governance and, you know, a need to negotiate with regulators, I think if we stayed on the quantitative side, we'd just be marginalised even by the way the regulation's moving. You know, the fact is that there's going to be a requirement to have a governance structure just to maintain that regulatory position. So I think we almost have to do it even if to stand still. It's my comment from what Peter said.
This was a more specific point about competitive advantage in relation to hedging. I'm assuming that was somebody from Canada. And then this whole question of how do we position actuaries? Are actuaries specialists in risk within a financial services context specifically, or are we specialists in risk who could
usefully contributes in general risk management terms? You know, could we help an industrial operation with managing its risks? And I think we're actually seeing actuaries who have worked for individual kind of corporate entities who are not insurers, not some kind of financial services institution, and they've had a useful experience from that. Does rather suggest that there is a kind of underlying skill set for actuaries that might actually be useful in a shared risk management sense. Does anybody have kind of specific experience of that?
Yes.
More of a yes than I will. We won't pin you down on it.
I think there's a difference between a skill. I don't know, I used to be able to do some mathematics.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter, excepting insofar as you can use it to generate some other benefit.
Yeah.
And the question here is an actuary an end result? I think we more or less agree with the answer is no to that. So actuaries getting involved in risk management, the question is whether or not actuaries, by virtue of their training, have some skills that can be very useful in business and in this particular field. And I think there are some very good arguments to say that that is the case. But to some extent here, if one has skills in risk analysis, then frankly one can apply them everywhere. And as many consultants, no doubt, in this room have done, they've been applied to commercial firms, including, in my case, oil firms. Now, you might not want to sell them there because they may not have many jobs and that sort of thing, but they should be very applicable in that direction.
Thank you. Did you have a comment? Thanks.
I think pricing is one area that's a bit underdone. I think, and I don't want to be controversial, but a lot of risk management is you can hear the sun steel door shutting and horses galloping away over the field.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to reflect on whether what we're doing would have stopped some of the risks that have occurred. And I'm not sure it would. There's been some fairly major ones. I think pricing is a key issue, that we need to be able to recognise risk and price properly for it. And we certainly haven't done that in the past. And I think if we start doing that, then we might engage management more, in that they would see that there's a source of profit rather than risk as being something that we should avoid, something that we should identify, price and charge. And I can sense reluctance in that, but I think we should always bear in mind the horse galloping across the field as part of the whole process.
That's a very good point. I mean, most of certainly in general insurance, actuaries' involvement is in reserving, which is after the event, and in capital, which is after the event. We're not necessarily at the front line. Did you have a point to make? Please.
I think as a profession we can learn from the Swiss experience, where it's not actually the actuaries who are doing the mathematical modelling, developing the model, it's the graduates with the PhD qualifications. The actuaries get involved after that. They get involved in trying to pull together the risk with the value, the risk and return equations. So I think it's useful to actually see it in that context. They'll be able to see how it fits in with the rest of the business. Like your Canadian example there. And I think that's it's related to the actuaries are not just risk managers. That's our skill. We tend to bring in different parts of the industry.
Yes. Yep. And a contribution at the back, please.
I think one of the other things that we need to, I guess, put our hands up about is that, say, mortality risk has the same issues, be it wrapped up in a pension fund or in an insurance company at the moment. These two worlds are just too far apart. So to be consistent about risk across the various sort of legal entities and areas where it takes place, and to do that ahead of regulation necessarily forcing us to do it.
I mean, on that point, do you think we might see more convergence between practice areas?
We certainly should. At the moment, there's, to my mind, a massive regulatory arbitrage that's available. Which shouldn't be the case, and B, if it's allowed to persist, we only risk ending up as a profession having more ego on our faces.
Thank you. This is Mr. Incredible's boss, who I suspect is an actuary. He's a little guy up there at the top. When we were asking the risk management questions, there was a definite kind of, you know, we thought we knew the answer. You were wondering with regard to risk management, you know, is it all there already? And what we were trying to ask was, do you think that there's a new language that actually have got all the skills they need anyway? They understand the concepts. Is it just a new language? Do they just need to present what they do already better in the correct language for the people who are going to make the decisions ultimately, or the regulator who has to be convinced about the soundness of the approach being taken? Or are there actually new concepts there that actually are not kind of understanding and have been taught? And then in the detail side, are the techniques that we just simply need to learn and need to be included within the training and the kind of CPD, the kind of post-qualification training of actuaries? And what was interesting was there was a pretty resounding yes to all three of these areas. There was a feeling that the actuaries had to learn not just a new language, but also some new concepts and also new techniques as well, and to get much more up to speed. And the point of kind of prior art, and that we shouldn't just invent our own solutions. We should be looking at what other people are doing and learn from them, getting up to speed. In fact, perhaps a skill as well as this kind of communication challenge for actuaries is, how do we quickly get to the bottom of these kind of more sophisticated techniques that have emerged in recent years, understand them, and become kind of articulate both in their use and their explanation. So we need a kind of renaissance actuary at this point. In fact, any comments with regard to those results? Please, Louise.
Other people have made earlier, that it's not just the actuarial stuff, it's the risk management, the sort of broader aspects, the management side as well as the quantification side.
Yes.
And seeing it as part of a process, not just doing sums.
Yes. Okay. Joined up with Smile. Key areas that got mentioned, not surprisingly, market risk. Life actuaries, I believe, are spending an awful lot of time looking at market risk. Many responses around corporate finance, hedging, value at risk, techniques used by investment banks. With regard to enterprise risk management, applying the process to measure and manage the risk across the whole business. And a lot of work's being done, mainland Europe, kind of anticipating Solvency II. In America as well, we're seeing enterprise risk management very much not being driven by regulation, but perhaps by an appreciation, well, maybe by Starbucks, an appreciation that risk needs to be managed explicitly and needs to be consistent across the whole operation. And of course, operational risk, and this is there where the ABI have been active. Peter, you've got the kind of ORIC initiative looking at operational risk losses, and then strategic risk, which I know the profession has been looking at as well. I think the problem with risk is it's probably just too big to take it all on. I don't know if people have got particular favourites they'd like to comment on there.
Why do people think it's too big to take on?
I'm just playing. I've got to admit, I'm concerned as an individual action that we are going to overpromise. That we're going to say we can solve these problems. We can do that. And that actually the questions that are being asked cannot be answered. I mean, you can demonstrate that it's a plausible and rigorous approach that can be taken, people can be satisfied by an argument. But in the end, given that we're dealing with extreme risks, there's never going to be the evidence there. There's never going to be a kind of scientific proof that the answer is correct. And I do worry about it.
I don't think that actuaries will ever have the answer.
Yep.
I think that if actuaries work in business in some of these risk areas, then they will probably be able to contribute to good and effective risk management.
Yep.
So I think that in a sense, the actuarial training offers a skill. It can be more focused or expanded into various risk management spheres.
Yeah.
But actually, risk management is a business process, and in order to be able to do it well, one needs to understand how to operate effectively in business, and manage people, and so on and so on and so on.
I mean, on that point, to the kind of floor at large, I mean, is the actual qualification going to become to risk what kind of accountancy is to business in general? Sorry, you want to have some points, Sam?
Yeah, I had a point relating to the prior conversation before you posed that question. It seems to me that the question from over there and your first answer to it highlights an issue that's been troubling me almost since about the first 30 seconds of this evening. There seems to be there's a tension between, on the one hand, wanting to do what actuaries tend to do when we get together in a group, which is to talk about what's our special skill, which was a phrase I wrote down from one of the earlier comments, and where we need to find a piece of space and grab it for ourselves. That on the one hand, the idea that there ought to be a piece that becomes the actuarial role, which is utterly consistent with your concern that would actuaries then overpromise if they try to work across all areas. And on the other hand, actuaries working in teams with other people, not labelling something as this is the actuarial area, but this is a piece of work, and if anybody happens to ask, are you an actuary, some of the people might say yes. And I see Peter nodding. It was absolutely, throughout his contribution earlier, which I thought was very, very welcome, it was absolutely throughout his contribution, this whole concept of linking the risk management to the running of the business and the regulation of the business. And I think we have, if we're going to make progress in this area, we have to stop thinking about what does the actuary do and think about what do risk managers do. Yes. And create an environment in which individual actuaries can contribute to that without having to say, I'm an actuary, therefore I do that bit. I'm not an actuary, I don't do that bit. Or my knowledge stops there. And that, I think, there's a bit of a tension there. And I think if we can move towards thinking about actuaries contributing in an area rather than carving out an area. And if there's any, I'm probably talking too long, but just as a sort of final remark on this, the history of the last 25 years is when things go wrong for the actuarial profession, it's always because they carved something out. We carved something out. I am a member. We carved something out, didn't talk to the rest of the world, and then when something went wrong, guess who got the blame, whether or not it was our fault. Yeah. So I think there's a tension there that we can resolve it.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
I guess one of the points that's in the back of my mind, we might come back to it later about the educational side, is that it seems to me sometimes that as actuaries, we're kind of defined by what we seem to be being trained to do. And there's a tendency to say, if we need to do risk management, let's make sure that it's in the exams and so we've all qualified and therefore no one should question us. But then it strikes me that all these other people in risk management, like PhDs and other accountants, have extended themselves beyond what they were trained to do. And much of the training that we have maybe should be a basic thing, but that shouldn't define the spheres that we work in, because someone's going to have to elevate to the board and do things they weren't trained for. You know, you can't just say, I wasn't trained for it, we don't elevate ourselves in that position. And it makes me wonder, and this is why the special interest group is of interest, is not so much that we should try and define how we can extend our training so that we end up with ever-widening and widening exam scopes, but it's to recognise that this is an area that we've got enough training in. We've just got to move into it. And as a group, you know, what do you need as qualified people to do, rather than, you know, do we need more exams, do we need more affiliations? And I think that I'd like to see us not always saying we're not trained for it, so we shouldn't do it, but actually just say, look, our training's done, how are we just going to get on and do it?
Please, thank you. Good point.
I don't think that training necessary. I mean, an education's a better word, but that's all tied up with the exam system too. I think it's really important that we don't fall into the trap of thinking we're actuaries, so we're clever, so we can just move into something and do it. I think it's important that we recognise that there is background, that there are techniques that we might need to learn about.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be through the exams. But you can't just walk in and expect to be able to do something just because you think you're great.
So were we saying that, you know, thinking about what the profession should be doing is one of the messages perhaps that we come back to someone who's got aspirations for their career to become, you know, active in risk management. Don't expect the profession to feed you everything that you're going to need.
No, but expect the profession to say, you shouldn't do something unless you know what you're doing. I mean, I think that's sort of pretty much the basics of our professionalism ethos. But that because you're an actuary doesn't actually stop you learning about other stuff too.
No, that's true. I've had a couple of hands come up. You choose, Mark. on the left and the right at the back. There we go.
Ashok Gupta speaking. I found a few of the last comments particularly pertinent, and I thought Simon in particular made a couple of very, very good points. I think management of risk is actually very different to some of the other things where we specialise. Business is fundamentally about risk. You put capital to work, you make a return on the capital by taking risk. So virtually every manager in a business has, as part of their job, managing risk.
Yeah.
So in terms of us looking at what we can do in managing risk, I think we have to recognise it's not an area where we can seek to have any form of monopoly whatsoever. It's an area, and I think the question we need to ask ourselves is where can we add value in that process? And I think we need to do that on an individual basis if we have any aspirations to manage risk. And we need to do it as a profession and say, is there any area in managing risk where we as a profession have, through our training, our skills, etc., can we add more value? Can we bring value to the management of risk? And the areas that leave out to me are around quantification and around financial risk. Now, it's very clear to me that whilst we may be able to add value in those areas, and some individual more than other, we certainly have no monopoly in those areas. And if I'm being very blunt, I think there are lots of people in the capital markets who have more claim to be able to add more value in the quantification of risk and financial risk in particular than quite often we do as a profession. So I think the point that Simon made, which is saying we have to be prepared to work with others and be very honest with ourselves in terms of where we can add value and where we need to learn from other people to enable us to add value, I think is key.
Thank you.
Just add sort of simple point that the phrase seems to be that are we looking to carve out a new area of responsibility for us? And I just wonder if that is actually the question or whether we're actually talking about just, you know, updating the knowledge and techniques that we supposedly have. And is it a case we've just been caught out being inward looking and places like banks have started to move things forward and now we've suddenly got a bigger step to make than if we'd have been outward looking all the time? Because it's not as if the first bank that ever started suddenly started out using VAR techniques to measure risk, but they did have risk management functions. Is that the piece that instead of carving out a new area, we've just been caught having to make a bigger step to update what we're supposedly actually doing?
Interesting point. I mean, I'm kind of perceiving from the comments that have been made that it's not necessarily about this language, this concept, this technique. It is about the operating model for the individual actor as well, and the way in which they can interact with the organisation they work in. So the distinction that we haven't necessarily picked up in our questions in the questionnaire.
One exercise which might be useful to you is to take the word risk and substitute dynamics, and at the same time take the word responsibility and substitute liability, and then see which of these areas you want to carve out. It also, actually just doing simple word substitutions like that risk dynamics one, actually gives you insight into some of the rubbish, like value at dynamics.
Do you want to respond on the virtues of embedding risk management, or should we give it some time to do the think of? Okay. What actuaries need to learn? Okay, here are some comments. We just need to have a wider appreciation. The issues are wider than the existing solution. I think that's coming back to the flavour of what we've seen before. And this is a key point, I think, which was perhaps, we had the comments about capital light, and getting this balance right between the risk for reward trade-off. And are we actually measuring that correctly? Are businesses just saying, oh well, capital, that's a cost, you know, they're not being able to kind of measure out the benefits of kind of taking on selling a particular product that might be more risky, be more capital intensive. So these comments here about getting a proper pricing regime, the point was made earlier, the key is an appropriate return on capital metric. A risk management framework is of no use if it simply logs potential problems. Certainly if the response to those problems is just to avoid them. And then the point has also been made about actuaries and our specialism in history and demographic risks, mortality, morbidity and longevity, where actuaries can take a leading role in developing risk management techniques and practices. And if I can just make a little plug here for something that we're doing with the actuarial profession, Brian Widsdale, who's chairman of the CMI, is helping lead and define some work that we're doing within the profession, not within the CMI, which is looking at scoping out mortality development research outside and well, beyond, including the actuarial profession, and looking at what, say, gerontologists are doing, psychologists, trying to understand, you know, what the state of the art is with regard to understanding mortality in order to inform better our future predictions as to where mortality is going, perhaps admitting, perhaps accepting that we've not got such a good handle on mortality in the past. And then coming on to the risk management taxonomy, no real surprises there. Yes, it's a good thing. 52% said willing to contribute to development. Of those who commented most noted that there was already a well-developed taxonomy, so don't bother reinventing the wheel. References to CAS, GARP and RAMP have done work in these areas already, and also papers coming out from Solvency II developments and even the original Basel II work. The general feeling was that we shouldn't reinvent the wheel. I think this comes back to, you know, we're actuaries, we're very clever, we can obviously do this far better than anybody else. The plain truth is no, people have been working on this a long time already, you should look at what's there. However, one participant did comment that perhaps some of the accepted risk management truths are perhaps flawed and unsound, and that perhaps a kind of rigorous reappraisal of those techniques would not go amiss, and that's a role that perhaps actuaries could play, or just anybody coming into the field could play.
It's a very interesting remark, which I certainly don't agree with, but down the bottom right-hand side of the screen, underneath the actuarial profession, it says, making financial sense of the future.
Yes.
And in my hand, I have a card that just expands that a little bit, and it might be illuminating just to remind you what it says, because this is the Institute's card. And it says, actuaries identify solutions to financial problems. They manage assets and liabilities by analysing past events, assessing the present risks involved, and modelling what could happen in the future. Now, you can argue as to whether that's particularly close to risk management, but I would have said that most people would probably agree that it isn't that far away. So why is there such a big disconnect between, on the one hand, an apparent statement of what the actuary and the actuarial profession stands for, which is pretty close to risk management, certainly intending to make a large contribution to it, and yet this feeling here, which is that actuaries have not, in fact, been very effective in risk management. Actually, it's probably right. So there seems to be a big disconnect between what the profession feels it ought to stand for and what it's actually delivering.
Please.
Sorry, my answer to that would be that what you just read out certainly overpromises and doesn't actually relate to what actuaries have done, or to be frank, are capable of doing, because I think it's beyond the wit of anybody to actually do all of that. So I think we just have to be more realistic about what can happen. That statement about service management concepts are flawed, I think is something that all actuaries or all actuarial students should learn at day one. Because the number of actuaries that get carried away with the wondrousness of their models and actually use the output as if it was some sort of, you know, tablets come down from
some
the mountain.
Some insight, yes.
That is something that we really do have to learn and make sure that everybody learns, that it's garbage in and garbage out. And you've got to be very, very careful how you use those models and the output. And particularly your customer, whoever it may be, needs to thoroughly understand the assumptions and inputs behind it.
I saw two hands go up, one at the back there, and then gentlemen there.
So I'm standing up here, and if I can just give you one little anecdote. I was assisting LAHT5 in the Terrible 5 inquiry on third-party risk, and I discovered that the model which the CAA was using ignored all outliers, all accidents more than 7 miles from the end of the runway, because most accidents in aircraft are on taking off or landing. But of course, the 7 miles from the end of the runway would probably land somewhere in Kensington, Chelsea, or you name it. And those are precisely the risks where the greatest mortality, third-party mortality, will lie. So it showed that the model that they were using was flawed for the particular point which they were using. And I've come across lots of very similar, not lots, but half a dozen, at least, very flawed models, which are, you know, people quite happily use, but they don't think about whether the model is appropriate or not. And that's why I put that suggestion in. Sorry to have upset you.
Sure. Do we have another saw hand going up over there? Is that yourself? Did you have your hand? No. The FSA gentleman. There, Mark.
I think it's quite funny that we're sitting in a hall where the net premium method has been discussed so many times. Everybody understands that the actuarial models are incorrect. I think the skill that we actually add to the life insurance industry and all the other industries we work in is that we can look through the models, understand that they are not perfect, and actually get ourselves to a decision, because this is not about trying to do modelling. This is trying to get a decision made. The very worst case we can have it is where decisions have to be made and there are no tools.
Yeah. I've heard people talk about the virtues of simple, flawed models, at least you understand them. There was a hand up there.
I just would like to add to your comment here about this net present value models. I think this was used obviously quite a few years ago because computers couldn't cope with more sophisticated models. And the point that this brings out is change, that your model obviously needs to reflect what currently happens. For example, you have some cancers that they cannot be treated. In 10 years' time, they can, so they no longer are a risk, and things like that. So we have to be open-minded and adjust the models that we do all the time to reflect the new circumstances.
Okay, this is my disappointing slide. The general consensus as regards research and what research should be carried out was there's not a great deal that kind of needs to be done that's kind of pressing to what the special interest group participants felt we should be looking at. It was more about disseminating what's already there, this whole thing. I think it's called sometimes synthetic research, where you basically get someone who's at the cutting edge or the state of the art, someone who understands what the kind of leading edge thinking is in an area, and get them to translate, to summarise that, and then to kind of pass that back to people who are, say, practitioners who haven't got the time to keep abreast with the cutting edge. And I think, certainly from my point of view, that's probably a response that we should be considering, is can we get more in touch with the people who are at the cutting edge, rather than getting every actuary to the cutting edge, can we actually speak to those people who are there and get them to help us understand what that kind of frontier looks like. Some things did get mentioned, copulas and tail risk. Was there a hand up there? Louise?
Isn't this consistent with the view that there isn't, in fact, an area that should be carved out by actuaries, that there are no specific research suggestions?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. And the particular point that got made, the operational risk, as I mentioned, is about positioning the profession and whether we're looking at ourselves as a force in wider risk management or in financial risk management, you know, in particular. Are we experts in financial risk management who are comfortable with wider risk management as a possible kind of way of presenting ourselves? We are to be keepers of market-leading financial risk models. I'm sorry to be kind of sceptical, but I just don't see how we could do that. How can we be keepers of financial risk models, you know, if you're talking about people that are looking at quite sophisticated, you know, finance products, and you've got your PhDs, your quants who are looking at this? But I think certainly in terms of custodians of the right way of going about it, I think that would be a good ambition for actuaries in terms of the concepts. You're shaking your head and it would be awful. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay, on to education, which is a bit more kind of, yes, you can do some certain stuff here. It's agreed this was a useful role for... I'll let you read it. Okay, we're doing very well for time, so if anybody's got particular comments on these.
Say, I mean, already exists, and I'm an examiner for ST6, and risk management and derivatives are basically the subject of yeah. that paper. I'll tell you, general risk management bits aren't so well answered as the other bits, but yeah. it's already there.
Okay, ST6. Note. Yeah. Sorry, Louise, I was just...
I'm Catherine Henshaw. I was just thinking in terms of risk management through the whole organisation. Maybe we need to think about that through all of education as well. Maybe questioning, instead of thinking about risk management as a topic that gets taught on the side, but as thinking about how we do everything in the light of wanting to manage the company, and thinking about how we teach pricing in relation to risk management, how do we teach valuation in relation to risk management, and having a much more holistic approach through the education that would then come through the companies.
I'd personally be very much in favour of seeing the actuarial education more like the driving test. It's not... Once you've passed the driving test, you're not actually necessarily a good driver, but at least you know the basics. I don't think that through the actuarial education system we can turn out people who are actually ready to do useful unsupervised work in a particular specialism. And what we ought to concentrate on is teaching basics, teaching principles. Sorry, popular culture. Remember those AA ads? I don't know how to do something, but I know a man who does.
Yeah.
Know where to find things out.
Yeah.
Just one observation, really, about education. When we sort of set up this in special interest group, we spoke to a number of risk managers who were non-actuaries about what they thought about actuaries. And they all thought actuaries were very strong in terms of quantitative skills, but pretty light on decision-making ability. And they thought a lot of that was to do with the fact that actuaries are not exposed to decision-making environments in their training. And they felt that as risk managers, and a lot of them who weren't actuaries, had been involved in things like, and this is in banking, they'd been involved in trading floors and other environments where they've had to make decisions. But when there's something quantitative, they give it to actuaries. And my only concern about putting more and more technical information about, copulas and economics into our exams is we're not moving to the bit that people regard as our weakness, which is our ability to make decisions and understand the procedures to make decisions. So my sense from people who look at us as actuaries is we have enough technical ability already. We're just not really expanding into the other kind of skills that a risk manager requires, basically. And that was feedback. That's not my view. That's feedback given by non-actuarial risk managers that I spoke to as part of the process.
Yes, some things just going through my mind there. And that I think one of the great weaknesses of the actuarial qualifications is you get pushed into a box quite quickly. And it's not obvious to me how anyone would jump to the conclusion through their qualification that risk management is actually a viable career option for them. And therefore, having a basic grounding actuarial techniques, but then getting some realization of basic risk management concepts, which enlivens them to the opportunity of jumping out into a wider risk management job, I think could be very, very good for the profession, because it will broaden our church and not leave us in this little black box where I can see us heading towards quite quickly, where we're left as the mathematical modellers with no real say in how the industry or companies are being run.
On the right, and then on the left.
I'd just like to come back to the comment that was on the that was read out from the actuarial professions card earlier on. And I think part of that might also have an effect on how one thinks about exams. I'm coming from the pensions field. Certainly, the exams that I went through are very much, you have a little box, this is what actuaries do. And I think someone then sat down and said, OK, let's think about some kind of aspirational motherhood and apple pie statement about the actuarial profession. What do? We manage risk. Perhaps some of those people who came up with those statements should then go back to the exams and say, how can we incorporate those kind of issues within the exams? How do we get students, and perhaps, you know, later us, you know, qualified actuaries in CBD programs and so on, to think outside the box and say, can we relate those to the wider arena of risk management within business?
Thanks, Matt. And then there's a chap on the right there.
It's Graham Farron. I've done, or tried to do more particularly risk management in my firm for the last 3 or 4 years. And I suppose I feel that I'm rather a one-eyed man in the land of the blind, to the extent that one feels that the actuarial training should provide a good introduction to risk management. I'm not sure that it does, but certainly when I see how actuaries do things and what they do, they seem remarkably naive and see life through rose-tinted spectacles. Whether that's because so much of the actuarial training, certainly when I did it a long time ago, was deterministic as opposed to stochastic, and therefore not reflecting the fact that there will be a variation in results, I don't know. But that's just something which occurred to me whilst I've been sitting down. But I've had this view for a long time that people have been naive, not just in my own firm, but in others as well. But I'd also just like to echo, I think, the comments that Simon Kahn made. No one's mentioned the role of the big professional firms, i.e. the Big Four, in what they're doing. But we're miles behind what we're doing in terms of how they, I think, help and advise or consult on risk. We may have the technical tools, but I'm concerned that in the approach that's come out of some of these summaries of the answers, and indeed the participation in the initial constitution of this group, it seems to be so narrow. Only 12% of the people were associated with pensions. Well, that seems to me to be ridiculous. This should be of as much interest to people who consult on pensions, given the assets and liabilities involved, as it should, I would have thought, to life insurance or general insurance, for the sake of argument. So I think we've got a lot of ground to make up, and one thing I would commend, if anyone is not a member of the Society of Actuaries Special Interest Group, then they should consider becoming one, because I do think they produce a well-structured newsletter from time to time, and whilst I've never been to any of their meetings, obviously, they do seem to be out of the technical box and therefore of interest both to management and others. And one of the first things, just as an aside, that I did when I was interested in getting into this field was I went to meet the risk manager at one of our clients, Rolls-Royce, and he was very interested in, because he had a particular perspective and charge on making sure that engines powered by Rolls-Royce didn't drop out of the sky. And that, in terms of managing risk, right, I didn't have the technical formulae and copulas, whatever they might be, that are mentioned here, but in terms of the dynamic management that they're mentioned, then certainly we've got a lot to learn in that area, and there's some general thoughts I should get in before anyone else makes them.
Excellent point, thank you. Can I have that gentleman just there, and we'll come to you, sir.
Thanks. I was just reflecting, actually, myself on why there were so few pensions people in the, I don't know in the room, but certainly in the survey. I am from the pensions side. I was also reflecting on comments that were made earlier that resonated about risk management having to be embedded in the business and not a separate, exercise. And on Ashok's point that this isn't, we haven't got any monopoly on this. And I'm figuring that the pensions guys, we've kind of failed on every count, because the pension scheme has tended to be something that has been, by definition, isolated from the sponsoring employer. You know, they make widgets, and there's this scheme. So we went off, and in isolation, came up with a bunch of assumptions and came up with a contribution rate recommendation without any kind of real meaningful discussion on what the risks were, etc. And the answer was 12, and that was fine. And we went away again. So we have an awful sort of long way to learn, I think.
Just on the education points and picking up on some of the previous comments about perhaps the need isn't for more technical material, which is out there anyway, part of the course. Is the opportunity really around post-qualification education in a much more formal sense? And actually, it's about how people can learn from each other the practical issues they faced and share those in a fairly, perhaps a more formal way and a more open way than we're used to. I mean, I think there's some big issues around this, not least around commercial sensitivities and that sort of stuff. Yeah. But it's kind of moving away from the seminars as, dare I say, pictures by consultants as to how we can do it for you, yeah, and moving back to the idea of here's something I tried and it didn't quite work and here are the issues and here are the problems, and actually sharing those things in a much more, yeah, formal sense. Both perhaps amongst your peers and with some mentors and things like, yeah, that. Yeah. And if we could kind of develop that side of the education, yeah, I think that could be quite useful.
I think the post-qualification point is a good one, because the skills that are being talked about as being valid sound to me quite mature skills about collaboration and learning from others and putting it into a kind of context. And without the kind of foundations to start with, it's difficult to understand what those relative differences are. It's an excellent point. And it might be the one that we'll take on board. So,
is it that we're moving towards a principle-based education system? In that it's about understanding and application that seems to be the big thing. I used to work for the MOD back in the days when they were allowed to sit there and spend as much money as they wanted doing as much research as they wanted. And then suddenly someone pressured them to be a bit more commercial. And that meant someone had to find, they had to go out and find the money for their research. And at which point it comes about how you apply it. And should we, as someone I think suggested earlier, leave the universities to these sort of detailed techniques and research at that level, and us think more about commercial application in our education system.
Thank you. Can I have a point from Corn and then from Martin?
James, if you are going to get into the education area, I'd offer two immediate required readings, the 1983 and the 1992 Royal Society papers on risk, and the difference between 83 and 92. In 83 we thought we could quantify everything, and by 92 it was very much subjective and Bayesian. The other thing you're going to have to do if you are going to put yourself into the business of educating people about risk management is you're actually going to have to define the boundary between operations research and risk management, because it seems to me that half of what's been talked about here this evening falls within the domain of operations research, and that is not a small field. One area which strikes me as being particularly relevant there is if you do start looking at the operations research, you'd understand immediately the difference between comparative statics and risk evaluation, which is something that a few papers recently seem to have completely misunderstood.
I didn't like it. Thanks, Colin. Mark here.
Just coming back on the earlier comment about naivety. I mean, I'm not so sure whether some of the issues of, you know, not being able to grapple the problems are naivety or just youth, or perhaps just lack of experience in the areas, which is perhaps what I said earlier on about it's not just the exam system, it's also, you know, continuing education. I think the idea early on about just getting together at a more mature level and sharing ideas is very important. And again, from the pensions area about coming out of the box, I would say in the last year or so, where, you know, in the past we've very much been just consulting to trustees or to the company and saying this is the contribution rate to pay, we now get into negotiations between the trustees and the company, and I think we've all learnt an awful lot in the last year or so about how companies actually run their businesses and how they use their cash flows when you're trying to negotiate with them to get some of that money for, you know, as far as the company's concerned, to get it out of the business into, you know, wasted money for the pension fund.
Thank you. Good point. Things are moving rapidly in pensions as well. I'll just quickly go through these last few slides. We asked about delivery mechanisms and qualified actuaries. I'm not too sure what this is telling us. Qualified actuaries, CPD events above informal, informal provision, 6 out of 10. And then if you look at future actuaries, you just swap the two. So there you go. Right. So, there we go. Additional education material. Most of you are willing to contribute to identification of additional material and better equip actuaries for work and risk management. Slight majority were willing to contribute to the development of the identified additional education material. And then, again, kind of specific ideas for material. CFA did get mentioned a lot. That seems to be a very kind of dominant, prominent player, particularly in investment. And then information from firm, GARP, Society of Actuaries, have obviously been mentioned before, the special interest group there too. And references to university courses with regard to the more sophisticated, more technical side of things. And then some suggested to produce a guide to existing resources or having a risk management section in the actuary itself. So I think I'll just wind up there and pass to the chairman before he cuts me off, just to remind you of the purpose of this evening, and I'll just pass back to David.
Can I say a sincere thank you for all your input? I did wonder how the event would pan out, but it's clear that people really do care about this stuff. So thank you that so many people have contributed. I think it's a clear mandate for us to do more in this area. I think you've given us a lot of food for thought and quite a bit of kind of directional input tonight. You've also I think told us some things that we must avoid, some mistakes to avoid, as well as some things that we can work on and do better on. I think as a group, the next step for us is to synthesize the input tonight and then to decide some actions that we actually need to take. It's clear that there are lots of directions we could go in, and the debate today has gone off in a lot of directions, so we're going to need to prioritize in some way. What I would like to ask is, I think we do have your details through the registration process. I would like to ask that you each maybe just think of one or two things that you would like the risk management special interest group to put at the very top of the agenda for things to actually do. So maybe you can, maybe we'll write to you and you can send us that. But one or two things that you'd actually like to see this group doing. We won't do them to you, we'll do them with you, and we'll get your input. Maybe also one thing that you would be willing to offer yourself. I did ask at the start for volunteers, I did mean that. And again, if you do want to get involved in this group and make a more active contribution, then do see me or James after the event. So we do need to follow up in that way. Please think about some actions and priorities. We'll meet as a group, as a committee later, to think about our own ideas for prioritisation, but I'd much rather be guided by you. We'll break for some food now. Please do make an effort to stay behind just for a few minutes at least, so that we can continue the discussion over some food and some wine. Mark has asked me to point out that this event does qualify for CPD purposes. It won't be automatically put onto your CPD register on the web page in the Institute's website, so you'll have to register the details yourself. Thank you very much for your contribution tonight. It's much appreciated, and look forward to continuing over food. Thank you. Thank you.